Gray hair, brown eyes. She had strong cheekbones, nice lines around her mouth, good teeth, a tan that suggested health without vanity. "What did you think of Nikki?" I asked, now that the subject had been broached. "I'm not really sure. I mean, I resented the hell out of her back then, but I'd like to talk to her sometime. I feel like we might understand each other a lot better. You want to know why I married him?" "I'd be interested in that." "He had a big cock," she said impishly, and then laughed. "Sorry, I couldn't resist that. Actually, he was awful in the sack. A regular screwing machine. Terrific if you like your sex depersonalized." "I'm not crazy about that kind myself," I said dryly. "Neither was I when I figured it out. I was a virgin when I married him." "Jesus," I said, "that's a bore." "It was an even bigger bore back then, but it was all part of the message I was raised on. I always thought the failure was mine in terms of our sex life." She trailed off, and the faintest tint came to her cheeks. "Until what?" I ventured. "Maybe I should have wine, too," she said, and signaled to the waitress. I ordered a second glass. Gwen turned to me. "I had an affair when I turned 30. "Shows you had some sense." "Well, yes and no. It only lasted about 6 weeks, but it was the best 6 weeks of my life. In a way, I was glad to see it end. It was powerful stuff, and it would have turned my life around. I wasn't ready for that." She paused, and I could see her reviewing the information in her head. "Lawrence was always very critical of me, and I believed I deserved it. Then I ran into a man who thought I could do no wrong. At first I resisted. I knew what I was feeling for this man, but it went against the grain. Finally I just gave in. For a while I told myself it was good for my relationship with Lawrence. I was suddenly getting something I'd needed for a long time, and it made me feel very giving with him. And then the double life began to take its toll. I deceived Lawrence for as long as I could, but he began to suspect something was going on. I got so I couldn't tolerate his touch. Too much tension, too much deceit, too much good stuff somewhere else. He must have felt the change come over me, because he began to probe and question, wanted to know where I was every minute of the day. Called at odd hours in the afternoon, and of course I was out. Even when I was with Lawrence, I was somewhere else. He threatened me with divorce, and I got scared, so I fessed up. That was the biggest mistake of my life, because he divorced me anyway. As punishment? As only Lawrence Fife knew how, in spades. Where is he now? My lover? Why do you ask? Her tone was instantly guarded, her expression wary. Lawrence must have known who he was. If he was punishing you, why not punish the other guy, too? I don't want to cast suspicion on him, she said. That would be a lousy thing to do. He had nothing to do with Lawrence's death. I'll give you a written guarantee. What makes you so sure? A lot of people were mistaken about a lot of things back then, and Nikki paid a price for it. Hey, she said sharply. Nikki was represented by the best lawyer in the state. Maybe she got a few bad breaks, and maybe not, but there's no point in trying to lay the blame on someone who had nothing to do with it. I'm not trying to blame anyone. I'm just trying to come up with a direction on this thing. I can't force you to tell me who he is. That's right, and I think you'd have a hell of a time finding out from anyone else. Look, I'm not here to pick a fight. I'm sorry. Skip that for now. Two patches of red appeared on her neck. She was fighting back anger, trying to get control of herself again. I thought for a moment she would bolt. I'm not going to press the point, I said. That's a whole separate issue, and I came here to talk to you. You don't want to talk about that, then it's fine with me. She still seemed poised for flight, so I shut my mouth and let her work it out for herself. Finally, I could see her relax a little, and I realized then that I was as tense as she. This was too valuable a contact for me to blow. Let's go back to Lawrence. Tell me about him, I said. What were all the infidelities about? She laughed self-consciously then, and took a sip of wine, shaking her head. Sorry, I didn't mean to get upset, but you took me by surprise. Yeah, well, that happens now and then. Sometimes I surprise myself. I don't think he liked women. He was always expecting to be betrayed. Women were the people who did you in. He liked to get there first, or at least that's my guess. I suspect an affair for him was always a power relationship, and he was top dog.
Do unto others before they do unto you.
Right.
But who had an axe to grind with him? Who could have hated him that much?
She shrugged, and her composure seemed restored. I've thought about that all afternoon, and what's odd is that when it comes right down to it, I'm not sure. He had awful relationships with a lot of people. Divorce attorneys are never very popular, but most of them don't get murdered.
Maybe it wasn't related to business, I suggested.
Maybe it wasn't an irate husband pissed off about alimony and child support.
Maybe it was something else, a woman scorned.
Well, there were a lot of those, but I think he was probably very slick about breaking things off, or the women themselves were sufficiently recovered to recognize the limits of the relationship and move on. He did have an awful affair with the wife of a local judge, a woman named Charlotte Mercer. She'd have run him down in the street given half a chance. Or that's what I've heard since. She wasn't the type to let go gracefully.
How'd you find out about it?
She called me up after he broke off with her.
Before your divorce or afterwards?
Oh, afterwards, because I remember thinking at the time that I wished she'd called sooner. I went into court with nothing.
I don't understand, I said. What good would it have done? You couldn't have gotten him on adultery even back then.
He didn't get me on that either, but it sure would have given me a psychological edge. I felt so guilty about what I'd done that I hardly put up a fight, except when it came to the kids, and even then he beat me down. If she'd wanted to cause trouble, she could have been a big help. He still had his reputation to protect.
Anyway, maybe Charlotte Mercer can fill you in.
Wonderful. I'll tell her she's my number one suspect.
Gwen laughed.
Feel free to mention my name if she wants to know who sent you. It's the least I can do.
After Gwen left, I looked up Charlotte Mercer's address in the telephone book by the payphone in the rear. She and the judge lived up in the foothills above Santa Teresa, in what turned out to be a sprawling one-story house with stables off to the right, the land all dust and scrub brush. The sun was just beginning to go down and the view was spectacular. The ocean looked like a wide lavender ribbon stitched up against a pink and blue sky. A housekeeper in a black uniform answered the bell, and I was left in a wide, cool hallway while the missus was fetched. Light footsteps approached from the rear of the house, and I thought at first the Mercer's teenage daughter, if there was one, had appeared in Charlotte's place.
"Yes, what is it?"
The voice was low and husky and rude, and the initial impression of adolescence gave way rapidly.
"Charlotte Mercer?"
"Yes, that's right."
She was petite, probably 5'4", maybe 100 pounds, if that. Sandals, tank top, white shorts, her legs tawny and shapely, not a line on her face. Her hair was a dusty blonde, cut short, her makeup subdued. She had to be 55 years old, and there was no way she could have looked that good without a team of experts. There was an artificial firmness to her jaw, and her cheeks had that sleek, tucked-up look that only a facelift can provide at that late date. Her neck was lined and the backs of her hands were knotted with veins, but those were the only contradictions to the appearance of slim, cool youth. Her eyes were a pale blue, made vivid by the skillful application of mascara and an eyeshadow in 2 shades of gray. Gold bracelets jangled on one arm.
"I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I'm a private investigator."
"Goody for you. What brings you here?"
"I'm looking into Lawrence Fife's death."
Her smile faltered, sinking from minimal good manners into something cruel. She gave me a cursory inspection, dismissing me in the same glance.
"I hope it won't take long," she said, and looked back. "Come out to the patio. I've left my drink there."
I followed her toward the back of the house. The rooms we passed looked spacious and elegant and unused. Windows sparkling, the thick powder-blue carpeting still furrowed with vacuum-cleaner tracks, fresh-cut flowers in professional arrangements on glossy tabletops. The wallpaper and drapes were endless repetitions of the same blue floral print, and everything smelled of Lemon Pledge. I wondered if she used it to disguise the mild scent of bourbon on the rocks that wafted after her. As we passed the kitchen, I could smell roast lamb laced with garlic. The patio was shaded by latticework. The furniture was white wicker with bright green canvas cushions. She took up her drink from a coffee table of glass and wrought iron, plunking herself down on a padded chaise. She reached automatically for her cigarettes and a slim gold Dunhill. She seemed amused, as though I'd arrived solely to entertain her during the cocktail hour.
"Who sent you up here, Nikki or little Gwen?"
Her eyes slid away from mine, and she seemed to require no response. She lit her cigarette, pulling the half-filled ashtray closer. She waved a hand at me.
"Have a seat."
I chose a padded chair not far from hers. An egg-shaped swimming pool was visible beyond the shrubs surrounding the patio. Charlotte caught my look.
"You want to stop and have a swim, or what?"
I decided not to take offense. I had the feeling that sarcasm came easily to her, an automatic reaction, like someone with a smoker's cough.
"So, who sent you up here?" she said, repeating herself.
It was the second hint I had that she wasn't as sober as she should have been, even at that hour of the day.
"Word gets around."
"Oh, I'll bet it does," she said with a snort of smoke.
"Well, I'll tell you this, sweetie pie, I was more than a piece of ass to that man. I wasn't the first, and I wasn't the last, but I was the fucking best."
"Is that why he broke it off?"
"Don't be a bitch," she said with a quick, sharp look, but she laughed at the same time, low in her throat, and I suspected I might have gone up in her estimation. She apparently played fast and loose and didn't object to a cut now and then in the interest of a fair game.
"Sure he broke it off. Why should I have secrets these days? I had a little wing-ding with him before he divorced Gwen, and then he came back around a few months before he died. He was like some old tomcat, always sniffing around the same back porch."
"What happened this last time?"
She gave me a jaded look as if none of it seemed to matter much.
"He got involved with somebody else. Very hush-hush. Very hot. Screw him. He discarded me like yesterday's underpants."
"I'm surprised you weren't a suspect," I said.
Her brows shot up.
"Me?"
she hooted.
"The wife of a prominent judge? I never even testified, and they knew damn well that I was involved with him. The cops tiptoed around me like I was a fussy baby taking an unexpected nap. And who asked him to? I would have told him anything. Hell, I didn't give a shit. Besides, they already had their suspect."
"Nikki?"
"Sure, Nikki," she said expansively. Her gestures were relaxed, the hand with the cigarette waving languidly as she spoke.
"You ask me, she was way too prissy to kill anyone. Not that anyone cared much what I thought. I'm just your Mrs. Loudmouth drunk. What does she know? Who's going to listen to her? I could tell you things about anybody in this town, and who'd pay attention to me? And you know how I find out? I'll tell you this. You'll be interested in this, because that's what you do, too. Find out about people, right?"
"More or less," I murmured, trying not to interrupt the flow. Charlotte Mercer was the type who'd barge right on if she didn't get sidetracked. She took a long drag on her cigarette, blowing smoke through her nose in two fierce streams. She coughed, shaking her head.
"Pardon me while I choke to death," she said, pausing to cough again.
"You tell secrets," she went on, taking up from where she left off. "You tell the dirtiest damn thing you know, and 9 times out of 10, you'll net yourself something worse. You can try it yourself. I say anything. I tell stories on myself just to see what I get back."
"You want gossip, honey. You came to the right place."
"What's the word out on Gwen?" I asked, testing the waters. Charlotte laughed.
"You don't trade," she said. "You got nothing to swap."
"Well, no, that's true. I wouldn't be in business long if I didn't keep my mouth shut." She laughed again. She seemed to like that. My guess about her was that it made her feel important to know what she knew. I was hoping she'd like to show off a little bit, too. She might well have heard about Gwen's affair, but I couldn't ask without tipping my hand, so I just waited her out, hoping to pick up what I could.
"Gwen was the biggest chump who ever lived," she said without much interest. "I don't like the type myself, and I don't know how she held on to him as long as she did. Lawrence Fife was one cold cookie, which was why I was so crazy about him, if you haven't guessed. I can't stand a man who fawns, you know what I mean? I can't stand a man sucking up to me. But he was the kind who took you right on the floor, and he didn't even look at you afterwards when he zipped up his pants."
"That sounds crude enough," I said.
"Sex is crude, which is why we all run around doing it, which is why I was such a good match for him. He was crude as he was mean, and that's the truth about him. Nicky was too refined, too la-di-da. So was Gwen."
"So maybe he liked both extremes," I suggested.
"Well, now, I don't doubt that. Probably so. Maybe he married the snooty ones and fooled around with Flash."
"What about Libby Glass? Did you ever hear about her?"
"Nope. No dice. Who else?"
God, this woman made me wish I had a list. I thought fast, trying to milk her while she was in the mood. I had the feeling the moment would pass and she'd turn sullen again.
"Sharon Napier," I said, as though it were a parlor game.
"Oh, yeah. I checked that one out myself. The first time I ever laid eyes on that little snake, I knew something was off."
"You think he was involved with her?"
"Oh, no, it's better yet. Not her. Her mother. I hired a private dick to look that up. Ruined her life, and Sharon knew about it, too. So up she pops years later and sticks it to him. Her parents broke up over him, and Mommy had a nervous breakdown, or turned to drink, some damn thing. I don't know all the details, except he fucked everyone over but good, and Sharon collected on that for years."
"Was she blackmailing him?"
"Not for bucks. For her livelihood. She couldn't type. She barely knew how to spell her own name. She just wanted revenge. So she shows up every day for work, and she does what she feels like doing and thumbs her nose at him. He took anything she dished out."
"Could she have killed him?"
"Sure, why not? Maybe the gig wore thin, or maybe just taking his pay from week to week wasn't good enough."
She paused, pushing the ember out on her cigarette with a number of ineffectual stabs. She smiled over at me with cunning.
"I hope you don't think I'm rude," she said with a glance at the door. "But school's out. My esteemed husband, the good judge, is due home any second now, and I don't want to sit around and explain what you're doing in my house."
"Fair enough," I said. "I'll let myself out. You've been a big help."
"I'll bet."
She got to her feet, setting her drink down on the glass-topped table with a resounding crack. There was no harm done, and she recovered herself with a long, slow look of relief. She studied my face briefly.
"You're gonna have to get your eyes done in a couple of years."
"Right now, you're okay," she pronounced. I laughed.
"I like lines," I said. "I earn mine, but thanks anyway."
I left her on the patio and went around the side of the house to where my car was parked. The conversation wasn't sitting that well with me, and I was glad to be on my way. Charlotte Mercer was shrewd and perhaps not above using her drunkenness for its effect. Maybe she'd been telling the truth, and maybe not. Somehow the revelation about Sharon Napier seemed too pat. As a solution, it seemed too obvious. On the other hand, the cops are sometimes right. Homicide usually isn't subtle, and most of the time you don't have that far to look.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 9. It took me a day and a half to come up with an address on Sharon Napier. By means I'd just as soon not spell out, I tapped into the Department of Motor Vehicles computer and discovered that her driver's license had expired some 6 years back. I checked with the auto title department, making a quick trip downtown, and found that a dark green Carmen Ghia was registered in her name with an address that matched the last known address I had for her locally. But a side note indicated that the title had been transferred to Nevada, which probably meant that she'd left the state. I placed a call to Bob Dietz, a Nevada investigator whose name I looked up in the National Directory. I told him what information I needed, and he said he'd call me back, which he did that afternoon. Sharon Napier had applied for and been issued a Nevada driver's license. It showed a Reno address. His Reno sources, however, reported that she'd skipped out on a big string of creditors the previous March, which meant that she'd been gone for approximately 14 months. He'd guessed that she was probably still in the state, so he'd done some further nosing around. A small Reno credit company showed requests for information on her from Carson City, and again from Las Vegas, which he thought was my best bet. I thanked him profusely for his efficiency and told him to bill me for his time, but he said he'd just as soon trade tit for tat at some point, so I made sure he had my address and home phone if he needed it. I tried information in Las Vegas, but there was no listing for her, so I called a friend of mine down there and he said he'd check around. I told him I'd be driving to Los Angeles early in the week and gave him the number so he could reach me there in case it took him a while to pick up a lead on her. The next day was Sunday, and I devoted that to myself. Laundry, house cleaning, grocery shopping. I even shaved my legs just to show I still had some class. Monday morning I did clerical work. I typed up a report for Nikki and put in another call to the local credit bureau just to double-check. Sharon Napier had apparently left town with a lot of money owed and a lot of people mad. They had no forwarding address, so I gave them the information I had. Then I had a long talk with California Fidelity on the subject of Marcia Threadgill. For $4,800 the insurance company was almost ready to settle with her and move on, and I had to argue with as much cunning as I could muster. My services on that one weren't costing them anything out of pocket, and it pissed me off that they were halfway inclined to look the other way. I even had to stoop so low as to mention principals, which never sits that well with the claims manager. "She's cheating your ass," I kept saying, but he just shook his head as though there were forces at work that I was too dim to grasp. I told him to check with his boss and I'd get back to him. By 2 o'clock I was on the road to Los Angeles. The other piece of the puzzle was Libby Glass, and I needed to know how she fit into all of this. When I reached L.A., I checked into the Hacienda Motor Lodge on Wilshire near Bundy. The Hacienda is not even remotely Hacienda-like. An L-shaped, two-story structure with a cramped parking lot and a swimming pool surrounded by a chain-link fence with a padlock. A very fat woman named Arlette doubles as manager and switchboard operator. I could see straight into her apartment from the desk. It's furnished, I'm told, from her profits as a Tupperware lady, a little hustling she does on the side. She leans toward Mediterranean-style furniture, upholstered in red plush. "Fat is beautiful, Kinsey," she said to me confidentially as I filled out the registration card. "Look a-here." I looked. She was holding out her arm so that I could admire the hefty downhang of excess flesh. "I don't know, Arlette," I said dubiously. "I keep trying to avoid it myself." "And look at all the time and energy it takes," she said. "The problem is that our society shuns tubbos. Fat people are heavily discriminated against. Worse than the handicapped. Why, they got it easy compared to us. Everywhere you go now, there are signs out for them. Handicapped parking. Handicapped Johns. You've seen those little stick figures in wheelchairs. Show me the international sign for the grossly overweight. We got rights." Her face was moon-shaped, surrounded by a girlish cap of wispy blonde hair.
Her cheeks were permanently flushed as though vital supply lines were being dangerously squeezed.
But it's so unhealthy, Arlette, I said. I mean, don't you have to worry about high blood pressure, heart attacks?
Well, there's hazards to everything. All the more reason we should be treated decently.
I gave her my credit card, and after she made the imprint, she handed me the key to room number 2.
That's right up here close, she said. I know how you hate being stuck out back.
Thanks.
I've been in room number 2 about 20 times, and it is always dreary in a comforting sort of way. A double bed, threadbare wall-to-wall carpeting in a squirrel gray, a chair upholstered in orange plastic with one gimpy leg. On the desk, there is a lamp shaped like a football helmet with UCLA printed on the side. The bathroom is small, and the shower mat is paper. It is the sort of place where you are likely to find someone else's underpanties beneath the bed. It costs me $11.95 plus room tax in the off-season and includes a continental breakfast, instant coffee and jelly donuts, most of which Arlette eats herself. Once at midnight, a drunk sat on my front step and yelled for an hour and a half until the cops came and took him away. I stay there because I'm cheap. I set my suitcase on the bed and took out my jogging clothes. I did a fast walk from Wilshire to San Vicente and then headed west at a trot as far as 26th Street, where I tagged a stop sign and turned around, jogging back up to Westgate and across to Wilshire again. The first mile is the one that hurts. I was panting hard when I got back. Given the exhaust fumes I'd taken in from passing motorists on San Vicente, I figured I was about neck and neck with toxic wastes. Back in room number 2 again, I showered and dressed and then checked back through my notes. Then I made some phone calls. The first was to Lyle Abernathy's last known work address, the Wonder Bread Company, down on Santa Monica. Not surprisingly, he had left and the personnel office had no idea where he was. A quick check in the phone book showed no listing for him locally, but a Raymond Glass still lived in Sherman Oaks, and I verified the street number I had noted from the police files up in Santa Teresa. I placed another call to my friend in Vegas. He had a lead on Sharon Napier, but said it would take him probably half a day to pin it down. I alerted Arlette that he might be calling and cautioned her to make sure the information, if she took it, was exact. She acted a little injured that I didn't trust her to take phone messages for me, but she'd been negligent before, and it had cost me plenty last time around. I called Nikki in Santa Teresa and told her where I was and what I was up to. Then I checked my answering service. Charlie Scorsone had called but left no number. I figured if it was important, he'd call back. I gave my service the number where I could be reached. Having tagged all those bases, I went next door to a restaurant that seems to change nationalities every time I'm there. Last time I was in town, it was Mexican fare, which is to say, very hot plates of pale brown goo. This time it was Greek. Turd-like lumps wrapped in leaves. I'd seen things in roadside parks that looked about that good, but I washed them down with a glass of wine that tasted like lighter fluid, and who knew the difference? It was now 7:15, and I didn't have anything to do. The television set in my room was on the fritz, so I wandered down to the office and watched TV with Arlette while she ate a box of caramel aids. In the morning, I drove over the mountain into the San Fernando Valley. At the crest of the hill, where the San Diego Freeway tips over into Sherman Oaks, I could see a layer of smog spread out like a mirage, a shimmering mist of pale yellow smoke through which a few tall buildings yearned as though for fresh air. Libby's parents lived in a 4-unit apartment building set into the crook of the San Diego and Ventura freeways, a cumbersome structure of stucco and frame with bay windows bulging out along the front. There was an open corridor dividing the building in half, with the front doors to the 2 downstairs apartments opening up just inside. On the right, a stairway led to the second-floor landing. The building itself affected no particular style, and I guessed that it had gone up in the 30s before anybody figured out that California architecture should imitate southern mansions and Italian villas. There was a pale lawn of crab and Bermuda grasses intermixed. A short driveway along the left extended back to a row of frame garages with four green plastic garbage cans chained to a wooden fence. The juniper bushes growing along the front of the building were tall enough to obscure the ground floor windows and seemed to be suffering from some peculiar molting process that made some of the branches turn brown and the rest go bald. They looked like cut-rate Christmas trees with the bad side facing out. The season to be jolly in this neighborhood was long past. Apartment number one was on my left. When I rang the bell, it sounded like the brrrr of an alarm clock running down. The door was opened by a woman with a row of pins in her mouth that bobbed up and down when she spoke. I worried she would swallow one.
"Yes?"
"Mrs. Glass?"
"That's right."
"My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator. I work up in Santa Teresa. Could I talk to you?" She took the pins out of her mouth one by one and stuck them into a pincushion that she wore on her wrist like a bristling corsage. I handed her my identification, and she studied it with care, turning it over as though there might be tricky messages written in fine print on the back. While she did that, I studied her. She was in her early 50s. Her silky brown hair was cut short, a careless style with strands anchored behind her ears. Brown eyes, no makeup, bare-legged. She wore a wraparound denim skirt, a washed-out madras blouse in bleeding shades of blue, and the kind of cotton slippers I'd seen in cellophane packets in grocery stores.
"It's about Elizabeth," she said, finally returning my ID.
"Yes, it is." She hesitated and then moved back into the living room, making way for me. I picked my way across the living room floor and took the one chair that wasn't covered with lengths of fabric or patterns. The ironing board was set up near the bay window, the iron plugged in and ticking as it heated. There were finished garments hanging on a rack near the sewing machine on the far wall. The air smelled of fabric sizing and hot metal. In the archway to the dining room, a heavy-set man in his 60s sat in a wheelchair, his expression blank, his pants undone in front, heavy paunch protruding. She crossed the room and turned his chair around so that it faced the television set. She put headphones on him and then plugged the jack into the TV, which she flipped on. He watched a game show, whether he liked it or not. A couple were dressed up like a boy and girl chicken, but I couldn't tell if they were winning anything.
"I'm Grace," she said. "That's her father. He was in an automobile accident 3 years ago last spring. He doesn't talk, but he can hear, and any mention of Elizabeth upsets him. Help yourself to coffee if you like."
There was a ceramic percolator on the coffee table, plugged into an extension cord that ran back under the couch. It looked as if all the other appliances in the room were radiating from the same power source. Grace eased down onto her knees. She had about 4 yards of dark green silk spread out on the hardwood floor, and she was pinning a handmade pattern into place. She held a magazine out to me, open to a page that showed a designer dress with a deep slit up one side and narrow sleeves. I poured myself a cup of coffee and watched her work.
"I'm running this up for a woman married to a television star," she said mildly. "Somebody's sidekick. He got famous overnight, and she says he's recognized even in the car wash now. People asking for his autograph. Has facials. Him, not her. He was poor, I hear, for the last 15 years, and now they go to all these parties in Bel Air. I do her clothes. He buys his on Rodeo Drive. She could, too, on the money he makes, but it makes her feel insecure, she says. She's much nicer than he is. I already read in the Hollywood Reporter, new to you, him and somebody else pulling up stakes at Stellini's. She'd be smart to put an expensive wardrobe together before he leaves her, if you ask me."
Gray seemed to be talking to herself, her tone distracted, a smile warming her face now and then. She picked up a pair of pinking shears and began to cut along the straight edge, the scissors making a crunching sound against the wood floor. For a while, I didn't say anything. There was something hypnotic about the work, and there seemed to be no compulsion to converse. The television flickered, and from an angle I could see the girl chicken jumping up and down, hands to her face. I knew the audience was urging her to do something. Choose, pass, change boxes, take what was behind the curtain, give back the envelope, all of it taking place in silence, while Libby's father looked on from his wheelchair, incuriously. I thought she should consult her boy chicken mate, but he just stood there self-consciously, like a kid who knew he was too old to be out in costume on Halloween. The tissue paper pattern rustled as Grace removed it, folding it carefully before she laid it aside.
"I sewed for Elizabeth when she was young," she said. "Once she left home, of course, she only wanted store-bought. $60 for a skirt that only had $12 worth of wool at most. But she did have a good eye for color, and she could afford to do as she pleased."
"Would you like to see a picture of her?"
Grace's eyes strayed up to mine, and her smile was wistful.
"Yes, I'd appreciate that."
She took the silk first and placed it on the ironing board, testing the iron with a wet index finger as she passed. The iron spat back, and she turned the lever down to wool. There were two snapshots of Libby in a double frame on the windowsill, and she studied them herself before she handed them to me. In one, Libby was facing the camera, but her head was bent, her right hand upraised as though she were hiding her face. Her blonde hair was sun-streaked, cut short like her mother's, but feathered back across her ears. Her blue eyes were amused, her grin wide, embarrassed to be caught. I couldn't think why. I'd never seen a 24-year-old look quite so young or quite so fresh. In the second snapshot, the smile was only partially formed, lips parted over a flash of white teeth, a dimple showing near the corner of her mouth. Her complexion was clear, tinted with gold, lashes dark so that her eyes were delicately outlined.
"She's lovely," I said. "Really?"
Grace was standing at the ironing board, touching up folds of silk with the tip of the iron, which sailed across the asbestos board like a boat on a flat sea of dark green. She turned the iron off and wiped her hands briefly down along her skirt, then took the pieces of silk and began to pin them together.
"I named her after Queen Elizabeth," she said, and then she laughed shyly. "She was born on November 14th. The same day Prince Charles was born. I'd have named her Charles if she'd been a boy. Raymond thought it was silly, but I didn't care."
"You never called her Libby?"
"Oh, no. She did that herself in grade school. She always had such a sense of who she was and how her life should be, even as a child. She was very tidy. Not prissy, but neat. She would line her dresser drawers with pretty floral wrapping papers, and everything would be arranged just so. She liked accounting for the same reason. Mathematics was orderly, and it made sense. The answers were always there if you worked carefully enough, or that's what she said." Grace moved over to the rocking chair and sat down, laying the silk across her lap. She began to baste darts. "I understand she worked as an accountant for Haycraft and McNeese. How long was she there?"
"About a year and a half. She had done the accounts for her father's company. He did small appliance repair. But it really didn't interest her, working for him. She was ambitious. She passed her CPA exam when she was 22. She took a couple of computer courses, too, in night school after that. She made very good grades. She had two junior accountants working under her, you know."
"Was she happy there?"
"I'm sure she was," Grace said. "She spoke of going to law school at one point. She enjoyed business management and finance. She liked working with figures, and I know she was impressed because that company represented very wealthy people. She said you could learn a lot about someone's character by the way they spent money, what they bought and where, whether they lived within their means, that kind of thing. She said it was a study of human nature. Grace's voice was tinged with pride. It was hard for me to reconcile the idea of this prim-sounding CPA with the girl in the photographs who looked pretty, animated, bashful, and rather sweet. Hardly a woman with a hard-driving purpose in life.
What about her old boyfriend? Do you have any idea where he is now?
Who, Lyle? Oh, he'll be around in a bit.
Here?
Oh, my, yes. He stops by every day at noon to help me with Raymond. He's a lovely boy, but of course you probably knew she broke off her engagement with him a few months before she passed on. She went with Lyle all through high school, and they both attended Santa Monica City College together until he dropped out.
Is that when he went to work for Wonder Bread?
Oh, no. Lyle's had many jobs. At the time Lyle left school, Elizabeth was in her own apartment, and she didn't confide much in me, but I feel she was disappointed in him. He was going to be a lawyer, and then he simply changed his mind. He said law was too dull and he didn't like details.
Did they live together?
Grace's cheeks tinted slightly.
No, they didn't.
It may sound odd, and Raymond thought it was very wrong of me, but I encouraged them to move in together. I sensed that they were drifting apart, and I thought it would help. Raymond was like Elizabeth, disenchanted with Lyle for quitting school. He told her she could do much better for herself. But Lyle adored her. I thought that should count for something. He would have found himself. He had a restless nature, like many boys that age. He would have come to his senses, and I told her so. He needed responsibility. She could have been a very good influence because she was so responsible herself. But Elizabeth said she didn't want to live with him, and that was that. She was strong-willed when she wanted to be. And I don't mean that as criticism. She was as nearly perfect as a daughter could be. Naturally, I wanted whatever she wanted, but I couldn't bear to see Lyle hurt. He's very dear. You'll see when you meet him.
And you have no idea what actually caused the breakup between them? I mean, could she possibly have been involved with someone else?
You're talking about that attorney up in Santa Teresa, she said.
It's his death I'm looking into, I said. Did she ever talk to you about him?
I never knew anything about him until the police came down from Santa Teresa to talk to us. Elizabeth didn't like to confide her personal affairs. But I don't believe Elizabeth would fall in love with a married man, Gray said. She began to fuss with the silk, her manner agitated. She closed her eyes and then pressed a hand to her forehead as though checking to see if she'd contracted a sudden fever.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I forget. Sometimes I pretend she got sick.
The other makes me cringe. That someone might have done that to her. That someone could have hated her that much. The police here don't do anything. It isn't solved, but no one cares anymore, so I simply tell myself she got sick and was taken. How could someone have done that to her?
Her eyes welled with tears. Her grief rolled across the space between us like a wash of salt water, and I could feel tears form in my own eyes in response. I reached out and took her hand. For a moment she clutched my fingers hard, and then she seemed to catch herself, pulling back.
It's been like a weight pressing on my heart. I will never recover from it. Never.
I phrased my next question with care. Could it have been an accident, I said. The other man, Lawrence Fife, died from oleander, which someone put in an allergy capsule. Suppose they'd been doing business together, going over accounts or something. Maybe she was sneezing or complaining about a stuffy nose, and he just volunteered his own medication. People do that all the time.
She considered that for a moment uneasily.
I thought the police said the attorney died before she did. Days before.
Maybe she didn't take the pill right away, I said, shrugging. With something like that, you never know when someone will take a doctored capsule. Maybe she put it in her purse and swallowed it later without even realizing there was any jeopardy. Did she have allergies? Could she have been coming down with a cold?
Grace began to weep, a small mewing sound.
I don't remember. I don't think so. She didn't have hay fever or anything like that. I don't even know who'd remember after all these years.
Grace looked at me then with those large, dark eyes. She had a good face, almost childlike, with a small nose, a sweet mouth. She took out a Kleenex and wiped her cheeks.
I don't think I can talk about it anymore. Stay for lunch. Meet Lyle. Maybe he can tell you something that would help.
Chapter 10.
I sat on a stool in the kitchen and watched Grace make tuna fish salad for lunch. She had seemed to shake herself, as though wakening from a brief but vital nap, and then she had put on her apron and cleared the dining room table of the rest of her sewing paraphernalia. She was a woman who worked with care, her movements restful as she assembled placemats and napkins. I set the table for her, feeling like a well-behaved kid again, while she rinsed lettuce and patted it dry, placing a layer on each plate like a doily. She neatly pared thin ribbons of skin from several tomatoes and coiled them like roses. She fluted a mushroom for each plate, added two thin spikes of asparagus so that the whole of it looked like a flower arrangement. She smiled at me timidly, taking pleasure in the picture she had created.
Do you cook?
I shook my head.
I don't have much occasion to myself, except when Lyle's here. Raymond wouldn't notice, and I probably wouldn't bother at all if it were just for me.
She lifted her head.
There.
I hadn't heard the truck pull into the driveway, but she must have been tuned to Lyle's arrival. Her hand strayed unconsciously to a strand of hair, which she tucked back. He came in through a utility room off to the left, pausing around the corner, apparently to take off his boots. I heard two thunks.
Hey, babe, what's for lunch?
He came around into the dining room with a grin, giving her cheek a noisy buzz before he caught sight of me. He halted, the animation flickering off and on, then draining out of his face. He looked at her hesitantly.
This is Miss Milhone, she said to him.
Kinsey, I filled in, holding out my hand. He reached out and shook my hand automatically, but the central question still hadn't been answered. I suspected that I was intruding on an occasion that ordinarily admitted no variation.
I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa, I said.
Lyle moved over to Raymond without another glance at me.
Hey, Pops, how's it going today? You feeling okay?
The old man's face registered nothing, but his eyes came into focus. Lyle took the headphones off, turning the set off, too. The change in Lyle had been immediate, and I felt as if I'd just seen snapshots of two different personalities in the same body, one joyful, the other keeping watch. He was not much taller than me, and his body was trim, his shoulders wide. He had his shirt pulled out, unbuttoned down the front. His chest muscles were spare but well-formed, like those of a man who's been lifting weights. I guessed him to be about my own age. His hair was blonde, worn long, and faintly tinted with the green of a chlorinated swimming pool and hot sun. His eyes were a washed-out blue, too pale for his tan. His lashes bleached, his chin too narrow for the breadth of his cheeks. The overall effect was of a face oddly off, good looks gone slightly askew, as though under the surface there was a hairline crack. Some subterranean tremor had caused the bones to shift minutely, and the two halves of his face seemed not quite to match. He wore faded jeans slung low on his hips, and I could see the silky line of darkish hair pointing like an arrow toward his crotch. He went about his business, ignoring me completely, talking to Grace while he worked. She handed him a towel, which he tucked under Raymond's chin, and then he proceeded to lather and shave him with a safety razor, which he rinsed in a stainless steel bowl. Grace was taking out bottles of beer, removing the caps, pouring liquid into tulip glasses, which she set at each place. There was no plate prepared for Raymond at all. When the shaving process had been completed, Lyle brushed Raymond's thinning white hair and then fed him a jar of baby food. Grace shot me a satisfied look. "See what a dear he is?" Lyle reminded me of an older brother caring for a toddler so that Mom would approve. She did. She looked on affectionately while Lyle scraped Raymond's chin with the bowl of the spoon, easing the drooling vegetable puree back into Raymond's slack mouth. Even as I watched, a stain began to spread across the front of Raymond's pants.
"Hey, don't worry about it, Pops," Lyle crooned. "We'll get you cleaned up after lunch. How's that?"
I could feel the muscles in my face setting with distaste. During lunch, Lyle ate quickly, saying nothing to me and very little to Grace.
"What sort of work do you do, Lyle?" I said. "Lay brick."
I looked at his hands. His fingers were long and dusted with mortar gray that had seeped down into the crevices of his skin. At this range, I could smell sweat overlaid with the delicate scent of dope. I wondered if Grace noticed at all, or if perhaps she thought it might be some exotic aftershave. "I've got to make a run up to Vegas," I said to Grace, "but I'd like to stop back on my way up to Santa Teresa. Do you have any of Libby's belongings?" I was relatively certain she did. Grace consulted Lyle with a quick look, but his eyes were lowered to his plate.
"I believe so. There are some boxes in the basement, aren't there, Lyle? Elizabeth's books and papers?"
The old man made a sound at the mention of her name, and Lyle wiped his mouth, tossing the napkin down as he got up. He wheeled Raymond down the hallway.
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't have mentioned Libby," I said.
"Well, that's all right," she said. "If you'll call or come by when you get back to Los Angeles, I'm sure it'd be all right if you looked at Elizabeth's belongings. There isn't much."
"Lyle doesn't seem to be in a very good mood," I remarked. "I hope he doesn't think I'm intruding."
"Oh, no. He's quiet around people he doesn't know," she said. "I don't know what I'd do without him. Raymond is too heavy for me to lift. I have a neighbor who stops by twice a day to help me get him in and out of his chair. His spine was crushed in the accident."
Her conversational tone gave me the willies. "Do you mind if I use the bathroom?" I said.
"It's down the hall, the second door on the right."
As I passed the bedroom, I could see that Lyle had already lifted Raymond into bed. There were two straight-backed wooden chairs pushed up against the side of the double bed to keep him from falling out. Lyle was standing between the two chairs, cleaning Raymond's bare ass. I went into the bathroom and closed the door. I helped Grace clear the table, and then I left, waiting in my car across the street. I made no attempt to conceal myself, and no pretense at driving away. I could see Lyle's pickup truck still parked in the driveway. I checked my watch. It was 10 minutes to 1, and I figured he must be on a limited lunch hour. Sure enough, the side door opened and Lyle stepped out onto the narrow porch, pausing to lace his boots. He glanced over at the street, spotting my car, and seemed to smile to himself. "Ass," I thought. He got into his truck and backed out of the driveway rapidly. I wondered for a moment if he intended to back straight across the street and into the side of my car, crushing me. He wheeled at the last minute, though, and flung the truck into gear, taking off with a chirp of rubber. I thought maybe we were going to have a little impromptu car chase, but it turned out he didn't have that far to go. He drove 8 blocks and then pulled into the driveway of a modest-sized Sherman Oaks house that was being refaced with red brick. I guessed it was a status symbol of some sort, because brick is very expensive on the West Coast.
There probably aren't 6 brick houses in the whole city of L.A.
He got out of his truck and ambled around to the back, tucking in his shirt, his manner insolent. I parked on the street and locked my car, following him. I wondered idly if he intended to smash my head in with a brick and then mortar me into a wall. He was not pleased with my arrival on the scene, and he made no bones about that. As I rounded the corner, I could see that the owner of the house was disguising his little cottage with a whole new facade. Instead of looking like a modest California bungalow, it would look like certain pet hospitals in the Midwest, real high-rent stuff. Lyle was already mixing up mortar in a wheelbarrow in the back. I picked my way across some 2x4s with crooked, rusty nails protruding. A little kid would have to have a lot of tetanus shots after falling on those. "Why don't we start all over again, Lyle?" I said conversationally. He snorted, taking out a cigarette which he tucked into the corner of his mouth. He lit it, cupping crusty hands around the match, and then blew out the first mouthful of smoke. His eyes were small, and one of them squinted now as the smoke curled up across his face. He reminded me of early photographs of James Dean, that defensive hunched stance, the crooked smile, the pointed chin. I wondered if he was a secret admirer of East of Eden reruns, staying up late at night to watch on obscure channels piped in from Bakersfield. "Hey, come on, why don't you talk to me?" I said.
"I don't have nothing to say to you. Why stir up all that shit again?
Aren't you interested in who killed Libby?" He took his time about answering. He picked up a brick, holding it upright while he applied a thick layer of mortar to one end with a trowel, beveling the soft cement as if it were a gritty gray cheese. He laid the brick on the chest-high line of bricks where he'd been working and gave it a few taps with a hammer, bending down then to pick up the next brick. I cupped my right hand to my ear. "Hello," I said, as if I might have gone temporarily deaf. He smirked, cigarette bobbing in his mouth.
"You think you're real hot shit, don't you?"
I smiled. "Listen, Lyle, there's no point in this. You don't have to tell me anything, and you know what I can do. Spend about an hour and a half this afternoon finding out anything I want to know about you. I can do it in